be all yours from this.
What's that?
Man,
there's a lot of them here.
Okay.
We'll see. Good afternoon, everyone. The joint meeting of the E-12 Education Finance Division and Education Policy Committees will come to order. Welcome to members, and I know others are en route. We have many items or testifiers for our very important agenda item today, early education. And I know there's going to be a number of questions. We're going to try to hold on questions until 3:30 or 3:40 or so, but we'll have ample opportunity once we're in session to further pursue this, which we will. So we're going to go first to our presenter, Melvin Carter, the Director of Early Learning from the Department of Education, and welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, all of our esteemed guests today, thank you very much. I appreciate the invitation to all of us, to our early childhood community today. I appreciate the attention to young children. Today's hearing, coupled with all of the investments that this body has made in young children over the past couple of years, really bodes well, I think, for the future of our state, as we know, really focuses on around our ability to care for our young children. My name is Melvin Carter, and I'm the director of the Minnesota Office of Early Learning, which is, as you know, a joint venture, I'll say, of the Minnesota Department of Education, Health, and Human Services working together to do better. I think essentially working together than we can working individually on behalf of young children in our state. Just as a primer, the Office of Early Learning, our mission is to partner with families and communities across the state and also to align human and financial supports across agencies to promote healthy child development from prenatal through grade three. There's three pieces of this underlined, which I'll just call out for your remembrance. Is first, we know that we really want to focus on partnering with the adults who work most closely with children and families in our community, in our state, those families and the communities. We know that we have human and financial supports across agencies, across communities, across our state that can come into better alignment, and we're working actively to do that. And we really focus on promoting healthy child development, not just education as traditionally thought of as education and learning, but with the knowledge that young children who develop healthily, who are economically secure, are going to go a lot further in school as well. More on that in a little bit. The final piece is that we really focus on ages from prenatal through grade three. While there has been a lot of focus around kindergarten readiness, a lot of focus around K through three, a lot of focus around babies, our challenge really is saying, let's really get serious about making sure that every child in Minnesota has the great start that he or she needs to succeed in school and in life, that really focuses on prenatal all the way through grade three. Our charge, like I said, is to do better for children and families working together than we can working separately. The three core functions of the Office of Early Learning are to really work on building that delivery system that's sensible and accessible, that's really focused around families and children, to really partner with local leaders and institutions across our state, both to identify opportunities for community-centric systems improvement and also to connect more effectively children and families to available resources. And the third piece is just to cheerlead to make sure that we're all aware of the critical momentum that we've made in our state. We have made a lot of momentum in our state, and to just continue to kind of push the ball forward as a state. I like this slide. You may have seen this slide before. A friend of mine who's a state legislator in Vermont sent me this picture. She took a picture of an agenda of a meeting that she was at once, and I know you can't read the whole thing, but I just want you to know what they discussed at 9 o'clock. And at 9:40, this is in Vermont. They're having a conversation in Vermont state legislature about, do we need a little Minnesota in Burlington? My answer, my unbiased answer, is you need a little Minnesota everywhere.
That's right. Okay.
So what are we doing? We have a huge investment portfolio of things that we administer as a state to really prop up families and young children. Our goal is to deliver all of these programs with excellence to make sure that they are connected to families and children who really need them, and to make sure that they're solving problems, not just individually, but really building them together around a set strategy such that the results that these individual programs are achieving are really producing something that's greater than the sum of the parts. It's really producing some kind of positive synergy moving together. As we move forward, we're all aware of the state's Race to the Top Early Learning Challenge, which has 10 projects. The state's Race to the Top Challenge is where we really kind of started focusing on making sure that we are working efficiently across agencies. As we know, that's an initiative that comes with a federal grant. It comes with a finite funding source. Also, much of the strategies in Race to the Top have been delivered in geographic-centered areas. And so as we move forward, I think the larger question is really saying not just the project within this grant, but how do we take all of those kind of initiatives, all of those resources that were on that laundry list slide that I just showed you on the last page, and how do we make them work together really well across agencies so that they're more than just a laundry list of resources, but really operating, I think, as a balanced portfolio of investments in children and families across our state. I'm going to share with you, obviously there's a lot of speakers here that will be speaking real specifically about different pieces of those investments. I want to share with you a bit of overview and also a little bit more in depth about a couple of the things that I think are really critical toward weaving that kind of fabric together, the systems building across agencies. I think that's critical toward kind of turning the curve in the state.
Excuse me, Mr. Carter, do you have a written handout to accompany the slides?
You know what? I don't have a copies of this. I do have, and I'll share with you in a second, I do have copies of our school readiness definition. By school readiness definition, which I'll get to that in a second if that's okay.
Yes.
Essentially, the story that I'm trying to tell you comes around this slide, and that is that we need a common agenda in our state for young children. It's not just education, but it's children getting off to a healthy, good start. This statement, healthy development and well-being lead to early learning success and a successful trajectory through school and life, really says we want children to be building the cognitive skills that we know that they'll need for school success. We want them to build those because we know that they'll need those cognitive skills for life success. And so to make sure that we have them set up to achieve that kind of academic success, we want to make sure that our children are developing healthily. That means that they are born healthily, that they're born on time at birth weight. That means that they are screened and that they're seeing their primary care provider. That means all of those things. We want our children economically secure. And so what this means, I think, is that as we are, you know, critically serious about making sure that every child in Minnesota is reading by third grade and is ready for kindergarten, that means not just investing in things like Reading Core, which we know say reading, but really investing in things like family home visiting, which we know is critical for family kind of outcomes. Really critically investing as a state in things like our CCAP program, which we know are critical for family economic security. And to the extent that we can build all of those strategies moving together, that's how we best pursue the academic success that we desire for our children. As a cheat sheet, I was talking with a mentor of mine who joked that he has a game that he plays with his directors, that the longer the story is before they get to any numbers, the worse the numbers are surely going to be. In Minnesota, we have the opportunity to start with numbers. So I want to start with numbers and just kind of share with you some of where we are. Right now in Minnesota, we have 5,700-plus children receiving early learning scholarships in 54 counties. We have over 1,600 parent-aware-rated providers in 45 counties going statewide at the beginning of next year. We have experienced an 87% increase in rated non-accredited family child care, a 77% increase in rated non-accredited child care centers. You'll hear more specifically about all of this stuff later, but I just wanted to steal the thunder of some of the accomplishments that we've we've made. Those are critical. Those 87% and 77% increases are critical because those are some of the places that we really have an opportunity to move the curve in Minnesota. Those are things this time a year ago we were talking about. How are we going to get engage more in non-accredited family child care? How are we going to engage more non-accredited child care centers? That's something that we've really turned the curve on as a result of a lot of really hard work and really good partnership by the people in this room, around the room right now, and that's something to be proud of. 80% of Pathway 1 scholarship children choose four-star providers, so that means our scholarship program and our parent awareness program are working well together as the children who are receiving scholarships. Those families are choosing quality. That's a good thing. This next bullet point is, I think, a positive surprise. 28% of children under 5 on CCAP are attending a highly rated 3 or 4 star program, which means beyond just the families who are receiving scholarships, that the families who are accessing family financial support through our CCAP program are also paying attention to the parental aware rating system as well and engaging that. I had seen that happening, but didn't anticipate that happening so soon. That's a good thing. And an estimated 95% of kindergarten students are enrolled in full-day kindergarten in fall of 2014. That's a good thing. This means families around our state are really taking us up on our offer to really invest in young children, and that bodes really well for all of the things that we are investing in young children for, all of the returns that we anticipate receiving as a result of those investments. I shared with you that we have revised our school readiness definition in Minnesota. I think the big things that are important to know about that is they engage multiple domains. This is not just about, as I told you before, about academic proficiency, but really includes multiple domains. The Minnesota Department of Education is committed to ensuring all children's readiness for school by providing comprehensive services and supports to children, families, and teachers. These include domains in different, standards in different domains, social and emotional, language and literacy, approaches to learning, arts, and cognitive. I do have handouts on this because it's a little bit dense, so I'll pass them around the room as we want to, but that's really critical. And so as we talk about really building one system, the challenge of early childhood is that we have so many different places where families access resources, whether that's through a family child care, whether that's through a child care center, a school-based pre-K, through a Head Start, as we'll hear about all of those things today. We have to make sure that we're aligning those things, and I think we are really well aligning a common set of standards for teachers, programs, and children around our state so that we can really actually be in the process of building one system, which we are, and I think we're building the best system in the country, which is why other states are kind of looking to replicate what the system is that we're building. And so having a common school readiness definition is essentially saying this is what we're all after, this is what we're all out to kind of build in these children that we are all seeing, and so that's why that's really critical. This is a definition, I should say, that has been had weigh-in and kind of buy-in from all three of our agencies and community partners as well, so which is a good thing for our state. One of our primary or world's best workforce goal is to make sure that all students are ready for kindergarten. We support this goal. Having that KEA, that kindergarten entrance assessment, which we've piloted in the state. I'll tell you a little bit more about that in a little bit. Having that kindergarten entrance assessment aligned to this, the school readiness definition supports that goal by promoting our definition for school readiness, by operationalizing that definition using evidence-based, valid, and reliable assessments. I want to point out that these are not tests, fill in the bubble tests. They're observation-based in the multiple domains. By providing professional development to teachers and administrators on the assessment, which is really critical. Obviously, you can't just create a tool and not provide the professional development so that practitioners around the state know how to implement that tool. That's really critical. And plan for ongoing support via our RCEs. Another one of our critical world's best workforce goals is having third grade students achieve grade level literacy through our Reading Well by Grade 3 plan, which really asks local districts to create a local literacy plan to ensure reading proficiency by the end of Grade 3 on a really local basis, but pulling those together statewide to make sure that we are local implementation of our statewide plan to make sure that all children in our state are really reading well by Grade 3. That is a critical benchmark benchmark, I'm sorry, as we talk a lot about kindergarten readiness, as we talk a lot about different benchmarks, reading well by grade three is one of the most critical places that we can really focus, as we know that a child who is not ready to read at grade level by the end of grade three, chances are, while there are exceptions, chances are that child may never actually catch up with their peers. So that's going to be an important I told you about our school readiness study pilot, our KEA. We had districts across the state who volunteered to pilot six tools with us. The purpose on this is to focus on classroom practice and tools that align to learning and academic standards. And really, our goal is to come up with a set of school readiness assessments that districts can choose from that are reliable, that are consistent across the state, that we can really take all of these investments in young children and make sure that we know through the percentage of children who are literate, who are proficient in reading by the end of grade three, and the percentage of children who, how they score on the kindergarten entrance assessments, to be able to assess our progress moving forward. This was a project of the Race to the Top, which has been going very well. We have been moving forward over the past couple of years or so. At this point, the alignment process is completed. Our menu of tools has been identified and adjusted. As I told you, we tested out six and adjusted those tools from six tools to three tools based on that criteria, based on alignment to our early childhood, early indicators of progress. Our first replication is in progress right now. So that's moving forward, like I said, as a critical piece to being able to build the kind of one system nature across across the agencies, across investments, across that menu of that I told you about at the beginning. Help Me Grow, changing courses a little bit. I hope you've heard a little bit about Help Me Grow. Help Me Grow is an initiative of the Minnesota Office of Early Learning. We're working with all three of those agencies, health, education, and human services, to essentially build a single-door access point to make sure that families across our state can access the services and resources that they need, much more efficient, user-friendly, and convenient. We had a summit about a year ago, meetings with stakeholders. I think about 150 stakeholders showed up to participate in that summit. We've had individual meetings with number of over the past year. We have entered into a planning year with National Help Me Grow Technical Assistance Center to help assist in planning and design and implementation for Minnesota, and we're in the process right now of building work groups to plan for implementation around really four core components of Help Me Grow, which are healthcare provider outreach, community outreach, centralized intake, and data collection. Essentially, the goal is for families around our state, families of children around our state, to be able to access this kind of central access point and be able to receive referrals and be able to connect with a broad array of services and resources around our state. It's a huge undertaking, but something I think that's critical for our ability to take, again, that laundry list slide that I showed you and make it make a lot more sense, make it a lot more easily navigable for children and families around our state who are trying to access them. No, that's our overview. As we move forward, we know that that providing access for children, that moving the curve kind of on a scaled level in our state requires our systems to be linked. This shows our school district systems and our community-based programs from start to child care to community education and school-based special education programs, really figuring out how to link those kind of together such that we are not only building our kind of early childhood system, like I said, across all of those kind of diverse delivery points, but also linking it well with our pre-K to third grade system, our pre-K system, to make sure that we have one kind of seamless one seamless system for families to engage with. So as we talk about our 0 to 3, actually that should read prenatal to 3. Our pre-K, we want to make sure that, again, within pre-K, all of the different folks who are working to get children ready for kindergarten, be that Head Start or school-based kindergarten, pre-kindergarten programs, centers or family child care, that we're aligning within and that we're aligning kind of across. The story that I tell as an old track guy is that anybody who's ever run a relay knows that four people with really good exchanges can beat a team with four really fast people every time. And so that alignment is critical because it's about the exchanges. It's not just about doing the pre-K work really well, but it's about connecting that with our work with babies, connecting that with our work with kind of the kindergarten through third grade to make sure that we're not experiencing the burnout effects that we've seen in different studies in different places around the country. So that's really critical to our work long term as well.
And Mr. Carter, we're almost at the finish line for this presentation, but we will have
and I'm
ample opportunity later.
And I'm at the finish line of my slide, so I appreciate your time.
Excellent presentation, and we will open for questions following the other testifiers. So, thank you. Art Rolnick. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee, for taking on this issue. My name is Art Rolnick, and I am co-director of the Human Capital Research Collaborative at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs, University of Minnesota. It's a institute. It's a partnership with the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis and the University of Minnesota. I was formerly director of research at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. At this institute, we focus on doing research on this very issue, on early childhood development starting as early as prenatal, and we look at programs all the way through age three. I'm here today to talk to you about scalability, about taking this, the success we're having here in Minnesota, and taking it to scale. I'm going to argue not only is there a moral obligation, there's an economic obligation to take this to scale to make sure all of our children, especially our children born into poverty, have access to high-quality early education. So first, what I'd like to do is talk about the scholarship approach. I call this the Minnesota model as I go around the country speaking on this issue and talk about the success we've had with that scholarship model empowering parents. Then I'll talk about the need to create the argument for creating a permanent fund, the advantages of having a permanent fund, a commitment from this state that all of our children will succeed. And then lastly, I'll talk about the specific fund that I'd like you to think about that exists and we could use to make a good start at this, bringing it to scale. Okay, so the success of the Minnesota Early Learning Scholarships. You may know this goes back a number of years with the creation of an organization called the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation. This is a foundation that was based on the business community, their vision, their money, $20 million, basically to do two things. One was to create a rating system, and as you know, it's now called Parent Aware. So about half the money that was raised, half of the $20 million that was raised privately.
Yeah, just come on in.
Absolutely. Was creating a rating system, and the other half was to see if indeed we could implement the scholarship model and get the double-digit returns that we were finding in the research. Now, because the research looked so convincing, MELF was created by a man by the name of Warren Staley, who was at that time CEO of Cargill. And Warren was able to recruit the CEO, Ken Powell of General Mills, Doug Baker from Ecolab, Mike Cerisi, Brad Anderson, who was CEO of Best Buy. The business community saw this as a very important long-term investment for a quality workforce. So it created this organization. We started Parent Aware, and we funded a pilot in St. Paul in the Frogtown area. We gave out 650 scholarships, and the returns were incredible. I mean, these kids almost overnight were starting to outperform their peers, and within a year or two, they were at levels that were very close to the national norms. Based on that success, we were able to convince Washington and race to the top to give us $45 million to replicate what we did in St. Paul. And as we're speaking, we're replicating that at the Northside Achievement Zone in North Minneapolis on White Earth. And I know the White House was very interested in seeing something like this on an Indian reservation and in an outstate in greater Minnesota. I'm very familiar with the results already that are coming out of the Northside Achievement Zone, and they're coming out of White Earth. And again, I can tell you we're seeing the same kind of results that we saw in St. Paul. I'm going to argue parents are parents. I don't care where they live. I don't care their color. I don't care their race. If you empower the parents, we can get the kind of results we expect for all our children. So that's the success of the scholarship model. Now let me talk about why you should think about a permanent fund. What's the advantage of a permanent fund as opposed to every other year kind of going through this process trying to figure out how much we can afford? I'm going to argue you can't afford not to do this. So a permanent fund, what are the advantages? Excuse the economic language, but first, there's a supply side advantage to this. Once the market knows that Minnesota is committed to scholarships for all our vulnerable children, watch how quickly the infrastructure is built. You don't have to worry about the infrastructure. In St. Paul, within a short period of time, when the market learned that that 650 families were getting scholarships that paid up to $13,000 a year, New Horizon opened up a brand new facility, I'm not sure which way to point, on Rice Street, right on a bus line. Montessori expanded their programs. Faith-based programs were expanded. Within a short period of time, Frogtown area got significant number of 3- and 4-star rated programs. I'm going to argue that's real economic development. We can get into that later if you want. So supply side, if they know it's permanent, the market is going to invest. Some of you are too young, but Mike Milken is a name you may know. The junk bond king, he came out of jail, did a few things he shouldn't have done, but he created a couple of foundations. One of them is educational. The Milken Group owns KinderCare. Mike Milken has made a commitment that wherever we create a permanent scholarship model, they will open up a high-quality KinderCare program for at-risk children, and they claim they're going to be the best, just like Montessori claims they're going to be the best, and a whole lot of others claim they're going to be the best. So I'm going to argue a big advantage of permanent fund is that you're going to get the infrastructure built with the incentive will be there. So supply side advantage. Leverage. If we have a fund like this, we can then go out and add to it through private funding and through the federal government. I'm going to make a commitment. I've been talking this up in Washington that if Minnesota created a scholarship fund, we can get some federal matching funding for it. So you can take, so in other words, once you have that fund in place, you can build it. Okay? Third, so leveraging supply side, leveraging the message to the business community. Minnesota would make message the following to the business community. We are making a commitment, a long-term commitment, to have a high-quality workforce. You must know this. The reason Minnesota has one of the best economies in this country is because of the quality of our workforce. I can't explain historically why this happened, but in the 50s, we started to invest in our human capital, and that's why today you're living in one of the most successful economies in the world. So to keep that, sustain that commitment, this permanency of this fund would be a message to our business community, not just those that are here, but potential people coming here, potential businesses, that you're going to be in a high-quality workforce environment. If you thought that was important over the last 50 years, it's going to be that much important over the next 50 years. Finally, it's a message to the families, a message to our vulnerable families that we care about their kids. We plan, give them access to high quality so their kids will succeed. So I think there's a strong case that can be made for a permanent fund. So lastly, what should that fund be? So you may know this. Minnesota becomes a state in 1858. Federal government gives us a bunch of land. It's called the School Trust Lands Fund. Land up north. Funds have to be used for education. My understanding, that fund now is estimated to be valued at $1 billion. My idea is a very simple one. Take that fund and we earmark it for early learning scholarships. There's $1 billion. My neck's on the line there. I would work for the next 5 years with the business community in Washington to get it up to $1.5 billion. You get it up to $1.5 billion. Notice I haven't had to raise taxes yet. You can fund. We're working on these numbers, and I'll have a report for you in a few weeks. You'll be able to fund every child born into poverty in this state will have access to high-quality early ed, which will include funding for home visitors starting prenatal. So that's the goal, $1.5 billion endowed fund. It's permanent. You're done. You've made that commitment. And I'm going to argue you won't find a better economic development investment the state can make. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rolnick. And again, we'll open this up following the testifiers. Donald Sisson. Welcome.
Thank you. Chairpersons, members of the committee, my name is Donald Sisson, and I supervise the St. Paul Schools Early Childhood Family Education Program, or ECFE. In St. Paul, our ECFE program is serving 3,500 parents and 2,900 children in 102 class offerings at 10 locations, two of which are in public housing community centers. These classes are targeted to best meet the needs of the families and include age-specific classes for infants and toddlers, culturally specific classes taught in parents' home languages, mixed-age classes, and 9 family literacy programs. Classes are held mornings, afternoons, and evenings. In addition, ECFE provides parent education to adolescents in high school settings, ELL students in adult basic education programs, and in homeless shelters. As a universal access parent education program embedded in community education departments in 335 school districts, ECFE is unique to Minnesota and is currently celebrating its 40th year birthday. Thanks to the legislature for investing in parent education and other early childhood initiatives last session. With this increase, our programming was able to expand its culturally specific classes, add an additional family literacy program, provide a new model of inclusion for families of children with special needs, and expand on transportation, which has become our second highest cost to programming. As we enter our fourth decade with new statute language, we will continue to meet the needs of our community through a mandated community needs assessment to better fit programming with identified community needs and to reboot the program with an ECFE 2.0 that will look at 4 enhancement areas that we will continue to modify to improve program effectiveness. Another statute change was in the area of home visiting, an important component required of all ECFE programs. Home visiting is currently funded through levy at $1.60 per eligible child. This has not changed since 1993. In St. Paul, ECFE receives about $38,000 for home visiting. We are currently spending more than $200,000 in general ECFE funding to support our home visiting initiative, and I'm sure this is occurring in districts throughout the state. Screening is another early childhood initiative that is largely supported in districts with ECFE funding. A requirement for kindergarten entry in St. Paul, we target our 3-year-olds for an annual screening and provide transportation and interpretation services as needed so families can better access screening. In addition, we are providing staffing support to our early childhood screening program. Finally, we are working toward alignment with our pre-K program and the pre-K to third grade initiative in the district through aligning curriculum as developmentally appropriate for birth through 3-year-olds and supporting parents and strengthening families. Thank you.
Thank you. And members, I think most of you see there are some excellent handouts and make reference to those as well. Please proceed. Welcome.
Thank you, Senator Wieger.
Chairpersons and members of the committee, my name is Vicki Turner, Assistant Director of the Office of Early Learning with the St. Paul Public Schools. I'm honored to be here today to discuss the awesome work that we are doing in early childhood. As part of the Strong Schools, Strong Communities 2.0, which is the second phase of the St. Paul Public Schools strategic plan of accelerating student achievement, we are addressing Goal 2, which is alignment and increasing pre-K opportunities in the following ways. We are coordinating with Early Childhood Family Ed and Special Education to increase citywide early childhood screening by age 3. Our desired outcomes are the early identification of health and learning barriers to direct resources and interventions, equal access to early learning experience for all, and to decrease the achievement gap. Secondly, we're implementing a co-teaching of pre-K and early childhood special ed program, providing inclusion opportunities. We have 11 co-taught classrooms that are staffed with pre-K classroom teachers and early childhood special education teachers and a teacher assistant. In each classroom, 6 students have IEPs and 14 are general education students. The teaching staff work collaboratively in providing inclusion opportunities for students with IEPs as well as meeting the needs of all students. Thirdly, we're building community partnerships to strengthen alignment of curriculum, assessment, instruction, and transition practices between childcare providers and schools. This fall, we have identified pathways at St. Paul Elementary Schools from community providers and beginning a pilot around our McKnight Pathway Schools with the St. Paul Music Academy, our CPC schools, which are Obama, and our Thomas Neighborhood Schools, Maxfield and Jackson. These providers include Bethel King, Holly Q. Brown, and New Horizon Childcare Centers. Fourthly, pre-K 3 alignment through the Midwest expansion of Child Parent Education Center, CPC grant, which is a collaboration with the U of M and Erickson Institute, with the goal of increasing reading by third grade. This fall, we have begun to expand to first grade in the 5 CPC schools, which is American Indian, Obama, Vento, Jackson, and Phelan Lake. We're providing professional development based on the work of the Erickson Institute on implementing authentic learning centers, purposeful talk, creating environments that scaffold learning, and differentiate small group instruction. Other program information is in the handout that I passed out. More information. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chairs, committee members, I'm Steve Kerr. I'm the Executive Director of Community and Government Relations for the Anoka-Hennepin School District. I'll refer you to this handout. Which isn't quite as colorful, I think, in your packet. I think in Anoka-Hennepin, we approached our school board with the importance of investing in pre-K. And in addition to the dollars that we were receiving through the community education funds and school readiness, the board agreed that this was a significant investment that we needed to make in Anoka-Hennepin to close the achievement gap. So our school board allocated an additional $600,000 to the funds that we already had, so that we could extend that, and we used some of the literacy aid dollars that this legislature approved to do that. With that, we were able to serve, in this last year, over 1,200 students. 54% of those students utilized the free and reduced scale, so we're hitting high poverty, a lot of ESL, and a lot of special ed students, way in an overrepresentation of our population. And we're having excellent results. I think the bottom line for you is that in essence, with pre- and post-testing, we can say to you that 90% of those kids were ready for kindergarten. Does that make a difference? You want to bet it does. Does it save tax dollars? Yes, it does. It makes a significant difference. It is a lot of things that have to be done. Leadership development, we put all of our early learning supervisors, all of our principals through the same kind of training. We have teachers shadow each other back and forth, both from pre-K and kindergarten. We've had to re-engineer the curriculum. One of the things you've often heard about is the fade-out of, you know, kids, that you have this big investment and then there's a fade-out. Well, some of the argument we made is, well, the fade-out happens because the system isn't prepared on the backside to receive those kids. So what we've done is put a significant amount of energy into re-engineering kindergarten, first grade, second grade, so that as we're bringing these cohorts of kids through at a higher level, that we sustain that trajectory with those students. I've provided you with some data about the success we've had, but I'll give you another story, is that we actually had to reset, if you will. We had to raise the standards because we screen all of our kids as they come in for kindergarten. We found that our kids were coming in at such a higher level, we raised the benchmarks last year for the incoming kindergartners. Those are pleasant things to have happen. So those are things that were in terms of the success side of things, and I've also provided you with a chart of how we fund our services in the school district. Since this is a committee that's looking at what are we going to do in the future, let me give you a few pieces of things that as I've struggled with how do we move the dial forward for our school-based programs, I would offer you this, probably in 3 categories. Define, invest, and build on current strengths. Define, and the define one is simple. It'd be nice if we were working off a common standard for what it means for a Minnesota student to be ready for kindergarten. Why it's important, as we found in Anoka-Hennepin, it was important because you needed to anchor your staff development. You need to anchor your investments. You needed to anchor your accountability and for community response to say, are we doing this and is it making a difference? So you have to have it to anchor all of your action pieces. invest. We would with this body made an investment in school readiness last year, which hadn't happened since 1991. I'm certain that there aren't any programs in the state that can stay flat for that long a period of time. We still have some additional needs to get at some of the at-risk population in Minnesota, and I usually would target that free and reduced as a pretty good measuring point of what that is in the state. Finally, in terms of building on the strengths, I'm suggesting that you provide developmental revenue for school districts to collaborate, align curriculum, and train staff across the pre-K through continuum. In Anoka-Hennepin, I'm lucky enough to have experts because of the size of our district. I can wander around and get enough people together that we can say, oh, here's a curriculum person, here's this and that. In some parts of our state, we don't have those human resources present in our school district. So I think if we had some development dollars, especially for some of our rural school districts, they could get into consortiums or collaboratives and try to share some of those resources and move that agenda along a bit further. Create financial incentives for school districts to work with local child care providers in terms of staff development and professional development. We have licensed early educators in our school districts who would be willing to do some things and work with some of our local providers and do some professional development. We've done some of those things with grants and other kinds of things. We've had some good success, for example, bringing in child care providers on special needs students and what they can do to enhance the learning environment in their settings. But there needs to be some incentive for school districts to kind of do some of those things. We don't have enough resources right now on our own. And finally, utilize the universal access. I've heard a lot about access, families accessing. Let me remind you, I have a delivery system across 350 school districts across this entire state of quality programs using licensed personnel, that if you invest in that system, the dollars will flow out to kids getting them ready for school. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kurt. Thank you. Excellent job. Pat Gannon. And Mr. Gannon will be followed by Erica Moss, and then I'll ask Mr. Forsberg and Ms. Jost if they could also join. Erica, you'll have your time allocation, but perhaps together in presentation. Welcome.
Chairpersons, members of the committee, I'm the Executive Director of Child Care Resource Referral in Rochester. And at our agency, we provide Head Start services, early Head Start, school readiness, crisis nursery, parent aware, child care resource referral, and child and adult care food program, all under one roof. That gives us some advantages in offering a joint application for our Head Start and school readiness programs. And I'll preface my remarks today by saying that my framework's a little different than some of my early education colleagues. My professional training is as a certified public accountant for KPMG, both on the audit side and then on the tax side. So my lens is a little more of a business person's lens. In fact, I often introduce myself as a certified public accountant masquerading as an early childhood administrator. But today I want to talk a little bit specifically about Head Start and four brief points in terms of our Head Start here in Minnesota. The first point is that the highest risk children in Minnesota under five and their families are waiting for Head Start and early Head Start comprehensive approach to early learning. Research supports the need for a holistic, family-focused approach that supports the social, emotional, and mental development of children from birth to age five. Minnesota's waiting lists for Head Start and early Head Start have persistently been high, with over 4,000 families with children under five on waiting lists in October of this year. In Rochester alone, we currently have 115 families on the wait list for early Head Start and 154 families on the waiting list for Head Start. Secondly, Head Start is an evidence-based intervention that works. We have short-term evidence that Head Start gets children ready for kindergarten. In fact, an example, we used our Pathway 2 scholarships in Albert Lea this year to provide intensive summer school for children who were not meeting benchmarks. And the result, after 12 weeks of intensive summer school, if you will, All 15 children in that program not only met, but many of them exceeded the benchmarks. Longer-term evidence is that it supports a reduction in special education, supports higher high school graduation rates, as well as crime reduction, all of which are good, as we know, for our Minnesota economy. 2013, independent analysis of four-year-olds enrolled in Minnesota Head Start indicated that programs get 88% of children meeting kindergarten expectations. Third, locally, Head Start and Early Head Start works in partnership with our schools and other early learning services to meet unique needs in local communities. And I'll give you an example. In Rochester last year, we opened up a 55,338 square foot facility in partnership with the Boys and Girls Club of Rochester. We run 10 Head Start classrooms out of that facility. It was 8 years in the making. We raised funds from local businesses and local individuals, as well as the New Markets Tax Credits and federal Head Start dollars. But what I want to say about that is that every day we have staff from the school district that work, the special ed staff works right in that facility with our Head Start and Early Head Start staff working with the kids and families. So we work very closely with our local school districts and also with other organizations in the community like Boys and Girls Club. So together with the Boys and Girls Club, we provide a continuum of support for these high-risk kids from birth. Really, those supports are available all the way up to age 18. That facility is operating 12 to 13 hours a day, which is pretty unusual for a facility like that. In Rochester, as I said, in other communities, Head Start is an economic development engine. We employ 70 full-time equivalents. We have an operating budget of about $4.5 million for our combined Head Start programs. And statewide, and this is the point in terms of leverage, these programs are bringing in over $98 million in federal funds annually. $98 million brought in federal funds annually. In social terms, you know, we say we transform lives. And in economic terms, we are in the business of human capital development. Help address the future workforce shortages projected by our state demographer as recently as an article in this past week in the Tribune. Fourth and final point is that the Minnesota Head Start community will be coming to the legislature to ask for funding to expand services to families who are waiting for Head Start and Early Head Start services, particularly Early Head Start home visiting services. Our waiting lists and school readiness data indicate more young families need these supports to help their children through the rapid growth and development that occurs in the first 3 years of life. Our data also suggests that at least 10 to 12% of the four-year-olds we currently serve would have benefited from an earlier intervention and services afforded by Early Head Start.
Thank you very much. Oh, next to Erica Moss, Frank Forsberg, and Nancy Jost. We have them all together with the linkage of many minds. And
sure. Chairpersons and members, my name is Erica Moss. My colleagues get settled, I'll just start. So in the interest of time, I'm the executive director of a nonprofit organization called Parent Aware for School Readiness. And one of my board members is Art Rolnick, and he did a great job of describing our heritage. We're the successor organization of the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation, coming in after the $20 million privately funded pilot of these initiatives to ensure their successful implementation statewide. I just want to touch again on a couple of things that Mr. Carter raised and maybe allow you guys to linger on them for a little bit longer. If somebody had told me 4 years ago when I started this job that I'd be sitting here today and we'd be talking about 40,000 high-needs children in three or four star rated programs around the state, 5,700 kids around the state using early learning scholarships. The tremendous growth that we've seen in Parent Aware in terms of the providers that are non-English speaking and non-white providers that are seeking ratings. Those two groups of providers are more likely to be rated than their English speaking white counterparts. And the tremendous collaborations and just growth up around these programs that we've seen in communities around the state. By my math, in the last 18 months, there's been about $2 million of new private investment attracted to support these programs. And what that looks like in local communities is local organizations doing outreach, helping childcare providers, providing no-cost or low-cost training to those providers to help them get ready to enter the rating system. It's just been really tremendous. So we're happy for all of that. And I wanted to just make a couple of remarks. You know, in the coming months and already today, there are going to be a lot of different types of pre-kindergarten programs before you testifying about the great services that they provide. And they all provide great services. And here in Minnesota, what we've been working on with the growth of the Parent Aware rating system is a single framework for determining which providers are providing high-quality early education so that all those providers can have an equal opportunity to serve kids in the state. And as I mentioned, we're seeing great uptake in the Parent Aware program. And I just wanted to give you an idea. You know, the Parent Aware ratings are still new, brand new in some parts of the state. But in other parts of the state, we've got more than 1,600 rated programs. These programs are rooted in a wide variety of cultures, races, ethnicities. They're big, small, medium size. They're found in rural, suburban, exurban, urban communities. They're home-based, school-based, church-based in some instances. And we really believe that all Parent Aware rated providers should have an equal opportunity to compete to serve families with early learning scholarships. These families who are out deciding among programs, deciding what's important for their family and what's the best fit for them, that it's families and children who really decide what's best, not providers. So that's the gist of what I have to tell you today. I wanted to also mention that we'll also be working through the Health and Human Services Committee here in the Senate to work on tying the Child Care Assistance Program to the Parent Aware ratings as well. This is something we've worked on for the past several years together with Senator Nelson and a bipartisan group of authors, and we'll be back again this year working on that as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairs and committee members, my name is Denise Mayat, and I'm the executive director of the Sheltering Arms Foundation and the co-chair of the Start Early Funders Coalition, along with my colleague Frank Forsberg, who will speak in a moment. The Start Early Funders Coalition is composed of over 27 foundations who are funding early childhood programs across the state. Start Early is also a proud member of the Mini Minds Coalition, which is made up of, at this point, I think more than 100 organizations statewide that all recognize that ensuring that our most at-risk children have access to high-quality early learning programs. This absolutely needs to be a top priority for the state. This coalition represents parents, early childhood providers, businesses, foundations, advocates, public health, public safety, teachers, and administrators. The group all understands that our state's achievement gap is unacceptable, that it starts early, and that it affects us all. The research is very clear that investments in early learning are one of the most important and impactful that the state can make. You've been hearing about this from some of the earlier presenters. Some of the things the research tells us is that 90% of brain development occurs before age 5 and that a large portion occurs before age 3. That high-quality early learning programs for at-risk children can help to mitigate stressors that could disrupt healthy development and have a lifelong impact on vulnerable children. That kindergarten readiness is a strong indicator for academic achievement as well as lifelong achievement. And that low-income children who enter kindergarten behind rarely catch up and are more likely to need special education, more likely not to graduate from high school, more likely not to attend post-secondary education, and more likely to suffer societal detriments like incarceration or health problems. On the other hand, low-income children exposed to high-quality early learning environments and who enter kindergarten ready to learn are significantly better poised to succeed. These are some of the things you've been hearing about in the course of the testimony. So today, I'm here to support the concept of extending our proven scholarship model that you've heard mentioned by several of the preceding testifiers to support children 3 and 4 years old and their younger siblings to enroll in high-quality early childhood programs. These scholarships are flexible and parent-directed, again, as you were hearing from Erica, follow the child, and provide stable support for low-income families. This investment builds on the successful scholarships that have already changed the lives of many children across the state and can be braided with child care subsidy funds. Thank you for considering making new investments in this area that builds so clearly on previous success for young children in our state.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and committee, thank you for having us come and present. My name is Frank Forsberg, and I work at the United Way here in the Twin Cities as Senior Vice President. And in that role, I get the opportunity to chair the statewide coalition known as Many Minds. And it was already indicated that in just 2 short years, we're just entering our third legislative session. The list of partners, which we provided for you, who have publicly declared their support for this effort, has in fact grown to 100 plus. And we are fortunate to gather more support virtually every week. And it's diverse support from business leaders to healthcare leaders to nonprofit and philanthropy. It is a broad and statewide diverse show of support for what I think is growing to be a consensus around the solution of early childhood and early childhood scholarships. We are very pleased that in the last 2 legislative sessions, with your leadership and support, we have been able to provide scholarships to more than 5,000 young children, which is great news. And the gap that still exists is an estimated 15,000 or so young children who are still on waiting lists. And so we're here to continue to advocate for those 3 and 4 year olds and their younger siblings so that their voice is heard and that we can continue to engage those young children in the high quality early learning environments that their parents would like them to have. The second thing that we're going to advocate for is to really focus on those most vulnerable families where the investment in early childhood has the greatest return on investment. We're lucky enough, because of the earlier presentation around Race to the Top, that we have 4 communities in our state that have 3 years of investment in early childhood scholarships, 3 years of on-the-ground experience. Those scholarships are flexible. They are often full-day, year-round. And that matters immensely to low-income families, especially those who are most vulnerable and are partnering those early learning services with services for the parents. So often the early learning scholarship allows parents to go back to school and to pursue their degree, or allows those parents to work full time and to become the parents they know they need to be to provide for a stable house. Following the success that we've had as a state in the 4 communities that have Race to the Top scholarships, we think would shine a great flashlight on a way to really emphasize and target those scholarships to the most vulnerable families. This requires us to continue to do good work on the legislation that was passed last year with making the scholarships more flexible and lifting the cap, and we already have that in place, so we'll be working with you and others to make sure we take good steps in that direction. I want to thank you again for this time. I want to introduce my colleague, Nancy Jost, from the West Central Initiative Foundation. And those of you who know Nancy know that she has a very clear perspective on needs and issues in greater Minnesota. Nancy?
Thank you.
Wow. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. Before I came today, I asked some of my rural colleagues what I should say. And first of all, they wanted me to say thank you for the scholarships that you have provided. And then the other thing they wanted me to say was more, 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 please. Because not all of rural Minnesota is able to benefit from scholarships. Many of our communities are just going to be eligible to be Parent Aware rated January 1st. So that was my short and brief point, but I thought you might need to know a few more things about rural perspectives of scholarships. So I just wanted to let you know there is some confusion in rural Minnesota, probably everywhere, about Pathway 1 and 2, who's eligible and how do they become eligible. So that's a concern for some people. There's also a concern about the 2016 switchover to using awards at just 3- and 4-star rated programs. And that's because we're just beginning, like I said, in 2015, we'll just be able to be eligible for Parent Aware in many of our communities. So it's going to take us a little while to build up our capacity. Another concern is that, or not concern, but another thing that you need to know is that awards relieve a very large financial burden for many of our families, and it actually allows parents to afford to work. It's given families more freedom to look at the quality of programs and what fits their needs best for their child and for their family, whether that's child care, Head Start, school readiness, child care centers, family child care. We need all of those options as families, as opposed to having just the option based on what they could afford. The third and final point was we have seen rural districts expand their pre-K offerings to more children, specifically that some have been able to serve 3-year-olds when previously they were only serving 4-year-olds, or the ability to offer more days, more full days, or even completely free preschool. That's a big deal. Scholarships are a big deal for families, programs, communities, rural Minnesota, and actually for all of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, each of the testifiers. Next, Mark Hernandez and Carrie Markovitz. They flew in from the University of Chicago to talk about a recent study addressing the reading, the importance of early developmental skills. Welcome. And for the record, please state your name.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Carrie Markovitz, and I am a principal research scientist at NORC at the University of Chicago.
Hello, and my name is Mark Hernandez. I am a senior research scientist at NORC at the University of Chicago.
So we are here today to present the findings from our independent outcomes evaluation of the Minnesota Reading Corps pre-K program. This study was funded by the Corporation for National and Community Service, and we have the slides coming up momentarily.
Members, we do have handout as well on this.
Oh, yes, and there's a handout also. Looks like this.
We appreciate it. Proceed.
So we really appreciate your time today so we can talk about the findings from our study. Just for some background, Minnesota Reading Corps is the largest AmeriCorps tutoring program in the country, and it is a strategic initiative of Serve Minnesota. The program is designed to help all Minnesota students become successful readers by the third grade. The Minnesota Reading Corps program mobilizes AmeriCorps members to implement evidence-based interventions to improve pre-K children's language and literacy outcomes. This presentation will provide the findings from a recently completed multi-year evaluation of the program, which was independently conducted by NORC at the University of Chicago. The purpose of the study was to assess the program's effectiveness in improving emergent literacy skills. We measured the effects of the program on 5 key indicators of early literacy. Those would be alliteration, letter sound fluency, letter naming, rhyming, and also vocabulary. We measured these indicators on over 1,300 pre-K students. who were enrolled in 26 Minnesota Reading Corps sites and also 26 comparison sites that did not have a Minnesota Reading Corps program. So just to summarize our findings first, we found that the Minnesota Reading Corps pre-K students met or exceeded all five spring benchmark targets, which allow us to conclude that the students on average who attended a Minnesota Reading Corps classroom were kindergarten ready. While the pre-K students at Minnesota Reading Corps sites met all five indicator targets, the pre-K students in the comparison sites only met the spring target for one measure, which was letter naming or letter identification. We also found large effect sizes in phonological awareness measures, such as rhyming and alliteration, and in letter sound fluency, which are all important early indicators of later school success, and impressive growth in vocabulary. So across all five measures that I mentioned, the program was effective. So next, my colleague, Mark Hernandez, is going to talk a little bit about some of the highlights of the findings.
So I'm going to share with you graphs that show three of the different outcome measures that we described earlier that, again, are important predictors of later reading comprehension. And I'm starting out with the one that is the most difficult of skills for preschool students to learn, and that is alliteration. This is knowing that the first letter of a word matches with the next one. So dog, dig, light, lamp. So alliteration, a hard skill. What you see on the left side of the screen, fall, winter, and spring is when we measured students' skills on each of these. The orange bar are students at Minnesota Reading Corps sites. The comparison site students are in gray. At the beginning of the school year, we matched our schools to make sure that they were equivalent at the beginning of the year. You see that they start with about two alliterative words at the beginning of the year. And what's important is to look at the spring. At the end of the year, after a year of being in the program, students at the Minnesota Reading Corps sites had eight alliteration sounds, and that dotted line shows you that's the benchmark expectation for grade level proficiency. So all students there met that. The average student met that. The students in the comparison sites did not. And this is an effect size of 0.72. That's in the bottom right corner of the slide. An effect size is a way to look at the impact,
the magnitude
of the impact, the outcome. And 0.72 is a very large effect. The U.S. Department of Education considers effect size around 0.2 to be small but meaningful in terms of outcomes. This is 0.7. By any stretch of the imagination, a large effect. The next outcome I'd like to share with you is letter sound fluency. Letter sound fluency is also a difficult skill. It's one that's matching that an L is la, an E is a, T, ta. Again, at the beginning of the year, students can two of those letter sounds equal in both groups. By the end of the school year, you see that the students at the Minnesota Reading Corps sites in orange are able to answer about 10.5 of these letters correctly above the expected grade level proficiency benchmark. The students in the comparison sites almost half that. Then finally, vocabulary. Vocabulary, what I'd like you to look at, again, the benchmark here is 26. The students in the program at the end of the year are at about 28. The students in the comparison sites, 24. This is also a large effect size, medium to large effect size of about 0.5. And vocabulary is important because it is the most important predictor of later reading comprehension, and it is a very difficult skill to move generally through intervention. Program was able to successfully do that. So for the most part, the program was equally effective for all students. We did do subgroup analysis to look at, did the effects of the program differ by the gender of the student, male or female, race, ethnicity, dual language learner status, are they an English language native speaker or not, the type of school, a Head Start program, a public school, a community-based program, that's neither of those two, and across the board, the program was equally effective. In fact, what we found were that in instances where there were differences, they favored at-risk students. So students enrolled in Head Start centers who tend to be are 100% low-income, free and reduced-price lunch eligible. Students who were dual language learners where English was not their first language, and non-white students all showed greater effects of the program than students that were not.
So it's commonly the case that when we provide an outcomes evaluation, that the next logical question is, so the program is effective. Now, why is it effective? So in order to answer that question, we also did a complementary process assessment of the pre-K program to understand why we were getting the effects that we found. And so what we concluded from that study was that the AmeriCorps members enrich the language and literacy instruction at program schools. And the program was effective, as Mark mentioned, in all types of schools observed, whether they're public, community-based, or Head Start programs. So our final conclusions were that we found the highly scripted, evidence-based interventions for struggling students that are used by the program, the rigorous training in early childhood language and literacy best practices for educators using the SEEDS program, and ongoing support from on- and off-site coaches were all key elements to elevating the entire classroom instructional culture. So for these reasons, we concluded also that the program is highly replicable. It's very specified. We understand what and why the program makes the program effective. And so we do believe the program is highly replicable. So just some general conclusions. The Minnesota Reading Corps pre-K program is an effective model for improving preschool students' emergent literacy skills. Significant and substantially large effects were found across all five areas of emergent literacy skills for 4- and 5-year-old students. Importantly, our process assessment findings support the outcome evaluation findings, indicating that the program's literacy-rich schedule, the SEEDS elements, and intentional instruction were all essential to the program's effectiveness. Due to these reasons, we've concluded that the program is highly replicable in multiple settings and across different student characteristics. And if you have any additional questions about the study other than during the question period, you can contact me or David Parker, who's at Serve Minnesota. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. Next, Judy Helper. She'll be followed by Jean Piccolo, and then we have a group at 3:40, and we'll open it up for questions. Welcome.
Chairman and committee, thank you very much. I'm Judy Helper, the CEO at Jewish Family and Children's Service, and I'm here today with Mari Forbush, our COO. I want to thank you for our previous three rounds of funding for this program since 2011, and I also want to especially thank Senator Bonoff for all of her support as well. Like many of the others that have presented this afternoon, we too are a member of the Many Minds Coalition, and like some of the others, Art Rolnick is also very familiar to us, having been a former member of our board of directors as well. And we have learned so much from Art about the return on investment in programs such as this one. We brought the parent-child home program to Minnesota approximately 9 years ago, but this program began on the East Coast in the 1960s, and it begins with a very simple premise that undereducated and low-income families are unfortunately presenting many fewer words to their children, their very young children, prior to kindergarten, which is a major barrier towards the children being school ready. And so the inventor of this program, a child psychologist, decided to create a home visiting program where a home visitor would come to the home twice a week with a toy or a book. Very simple, nothing scientific or fancy, but using this toy or book would use it as a vehicle for introducing language into the home. At the first visit every week, at the first 30-minute visit, the home visitor basically uses the toy or the book as instruction towards eliciting language, using language, and getting the parent and the child engaged in language. This program begins, I should mention, at 18 months and goes through 36 months of age. The toy, the book, is left with the family. And 2 days later, the home visitor comes back for another 30-minute visit, at which point is much more in the observatory role, watching the interaction between child and parent. This goes on for 30 weeks a year, 60 visits a year for 2 years, a total of 120 visits. It's a very simple program. It works very well in all environments. We have been doing this for, as I said, 9 years. We've been providing the service to suburban families, urban families, and greater Minnesota families. Most recently, with our most recent funding, we brought this program to the Northland and to the Leech Lake Indian Reservation families, where it has been working beautifully. What we like about this program, and Mari's going to talk about its impact, which we really like, but what we like about it is that families don't have to be in trouble. They're not being, stigmatized in any way. This is a voluntary program, and it is very welcomed because the family not only gets an opportunity to have a visit twice a week and to develop that relationship, but also gets a chance to spend quality time, important time, parent and child, and enjoy these lovely toys and books.
Thank you so much for having us today, Mr. Chairman and Committee. And the thing is, the program is...
For the record, please state your name. For the
focused
tape.
On the children, but secretly, it's training the parents to be more engaged with their children. And that's what happens. And when parents are more engaged with their children do better in school. And so what we have found with this program over the 45 years that they have been doing very, very careful research on this program is that 90% of children demonstrate age-appropriate development by the end of year two in six domains: personal, social, communication, gross motor, fine motor, problem solving, and social emotional. These things are all important for school readiness. 99% of the parents demonstrate positive, effective parent-child techniques, such as praising the child for positive behavior and speaking calmly to diffuse a high-stress situation. 94% of the parents increase their knowledge and awareness of child development. 100% of families receive an average of 6 referrals for community resources to help them increase stability and become more integrated into their communities. And 99% of graduate children enroll in a 4-star preschool. Based on the national research over these 45 years, children graduate from high school at the same rate as their middle-class peers. Parents improve their own lives. They say, oh, look, my children are smart. My children are smart. I must be smart. And then subsequent children also benefit from this program. They go on to get their GEDs, to obtain citizenship, to get a better job, and the family improves as a whole. And parents continue to advocate for their children in school, which is so important for their children's success. The final thing I just want to mention is that very conservatively, the return on the investment for this program, for every dollar invested, $5.70 of state tax funding is returned.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Next, Gene Pickle.
Mr. Chair and members, Eugene Piccolo, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools. Thank you for the opportunity to share a few thoughts. First, the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools really appreciates the effort by the legislature to assist families that do not have the financial means to obtain learning opportunities for their children. This is especially true with the population that we serve. We have twice the poverty rate of the state in terms of the students who attend our schools and 3 times the English as second language rate of the state in terms of our population. Second, at this point in time, we have 10% of our charter schools offering state-approved preschool or pre-K programs, and a number of other schools that have submitted applications for approval or in the process of developing their applications for approval. Third, I want to mention 2 issues that deal with linkages and access for families. Last year, the legislature changed the charter school law to clarify that charter schools, which are nonprofit corporations, could have state-approved preschool or pre-K programs if approved by the Department of Education.
This was an important step in clarifying who had oversight over those programs, because prior to that, it was unclear which state agency had any role over oversight. What was not amended, however, is that these programs are still considered auxiliary programs outside of the charter. So we would ask the legislature to amend the charter school law to define the charter school being preschool through grade 12. Without it, students in preschool and pre-K programs are not considered to be students of the charter school and thus must enter the lottery if they want to continue into the K program. This is especially the case, for example, in Montessori schools, where there's a three-year cohort of preschool and kindergarten programs. Those kids cannot automatically go into kindergarten without going through the lottery, and they may not get into the program that they've been part of for 2 years. Second, there was also a provision last year that provided that if a child attended a preschool or pre-K kindergarten program free, they would have an enrollment preference, like other siblings, in the charter school kindergarten program. When that legislation was enacted, it was understood that the student was attending the program free and not that the whole program had to be free. However, that's how it's been interpreted since the legislation was passed. So we would ask the legislature to clarify that the low-income preference is for students who attend free or on scholarship, and not that the entire preschool or pre-K program is free. And finally, in discussing this with our school leaders, one of the questions that has come up is that, for example, one executive director indicated that they have over 90% low-income students in their school. And the question became, how do we sustain these kinds of programs for preschool and pre-K, given the level of funding for the scholarships and other funding sources? So we would ask the legislature to increase the dollar level of scholarships and look at how we provide ongoing sustainable funding for these programs. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Piccolo. And next we have a panel, Rural Education Perspective. And as you approach, I believe Senator Saxhog has actually been chairing an interim look at rural opportunities as well overall in the state. So I just segueing, but we'll have a chance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Renee Nolting. I am the Executive Director of United Way of West Central Minnesota. And I'm here today to talk about early education along with another group from my task at NJOERE. Our United Way has been vested in early education for a long time. We operate a Growmobile program for the last 6 years, which is a mobile preschool, which makes me really excited about this program. I'm also a school board member of New London Spicer Schools. Our program in the last 6 years reaches about 250 kids per year with a free preschool programming. But what happened about 3 years ago, a major donor came to us and said that in the Wilma area, he wanted to see his donation do greater good in his community. At that time, Wilma was a focus and a priority school. With that challenge laid out in front of us, we reached out to our members in the community that were collaborators, partners in early ed, and started collaborating on a different level and created what was called the Wilma Early Childhood Cabinet. This cabinet contained members of the Wilma Public Schools, the early childhood programs in the area, Head Start, public health, also child care centers, and family daycare providers, and members of Parent Aware, just starting in our region. At that time, our United Way improved our Growmobile program to add assessment pieces, which we hadn't had in the past, that measured how our kids are doing at our sites. And we also used the Create a Curriculum, which was used by other Parent Aware providers in the region. Through that partnership, funding was created to get those pieces there. On top of that, the committee recognized 3 years ago that only half the kids in the Wilmer area were getting a preschool experience. We started thinking outside the box, and one of the methods that United Way was able to help, thanks to Wilmer Public Schools, is that we added three additional sites to other 15 that were non-traditional. We went right into apartment buildings and started doing preschool right in their lobbies. And soon after time, thanks to Wilmer Public Schools, these apartments were Somali-based communities and Hispanic-based. The school district provided liaisons that could translate for us so we could build partnerships and build relationships with these families.
Good afternoon, Chairman, members of the board. Thank you so much for having us here today. I'm going to build on what Renee has talked about with the Wilmer Children's Cabinet. We developed a four-prong approach to really maximize programming for all children in Willmar, kind of linking childcare, school-based, United Way, Head Start across the board to really maximize what we are doing and pulling together our partners. And the first prong is alignment. And so what we did is we sat down as a group and looked at currently what is being offered as far as curriculum and assessment in our community. And we had determined that creative curriculum in TS Gold was the majority that was being used across the board. So we had chosen to adapt that in Willmar to use within the school system, within Head Start, within our child care partners, and also with the Growmobile. And then as far as the assessment, it was the TS Gold. So again, we have provided the assessment to all of our partners, and we have also provided iPads to three of the child care providers that the Growmobile does go to, so we can track those children as well. So we've really come together to really try and bridge a gap that we have had in Willmar by aligning creative or our assessment and our curriculum. The other piece to this is professional development. We have worked with our Head Start programs, and they have trained the school-based providers as well as our child care providers on TS Gold and creative curriculum. And then we are currently working on doing some local training so that we have in-house trainers, so we do not need to go really outside of our region for training, that we can do it in-house and locally. And we are currently working on developing web-based training for our child care providers and our center-based providers as well. And then also enhanced outreach, which Renee had touched on with the Growmobile and the cultural liaisons. We have been able to reach areas of the community that we have not reached before. And what that has done is we have increased our EL services, the number of students that we have seen in EL up to 62%, which has been a significant growth for us in Willmar. And then we've also expanded our capacity. When Willmar was chosen to be a parent aware rated site, only the school-based Head Start and accredited centers were able to become parent aware rated. And within the school district, we did not have the capacity to increase the number of slots that we had available to the need that we had. So what we did is we looked at adding satellite sites to our school readiness program, and we have worked with the YMCA Child Care Center as well as the family child care provider. They are under the school readiness umbrella, and they offer school readiness services under using all of the guidelines that we need to do for the state as well. And so that's how we've been able to expand the capacity of school readiness in Willmar. And as just in closing, as coordinator of the early childhood programs in Willmar Community Ed and Rec and Willmar Public Schools, in greater Minnesota, schools tend to have the ability to take the leadership role on to pull all of these entities together. So we just ask for the continued or increased funding that will assist us to move our work forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Chairperson and committee members. My name is Jan Reindl, and I'm the Invest Early Director in Itasca County as well as the ECFE and School Readiness Coordinator. Invest Early is an early childhood initiative in Itasca County. Our collaborative includes Head Start, school districts, public health, and is in its 10th year. We're also a Race to the Top transformation zone, and the Itasca Area Schools Collaborative is an administrator of the scholarships in our area. The Blandon Foundation recently renewed its 10-year commitment for an additional 10 years to Invest Early, and I feel that's due to the fact that we are improving outcomes for children the way that we work together, and it's also that we're focused on a systems change. What's important to remember about Invest Early is that our commitment to partnerships keeps us looking at the big picture for our region, and we are stronger as a county because of it. Our partnerships between Head Start, school districts, family child cares takes work, but the result is a truly collaborative program that honors the requirements of all agencies while enhancing both the quality and the amount of programming that we're able to offer. We would urge you to consider a strategy of incentivizing groups to work in partnerships.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Matt Gross. I'm the superintendent for Deer River Schools. And I'd like to echo what Dr. Rolnick said earlier about this being a moral imperative. I believe strongly that the notion of economic benefit is great, but when I see a little child in the room earlier, Mary Ciccone was here, that really is what it's about for me as a superintendent and as a dad. So I'd echo that sentiment that it's the right thing to do. We've learned a lot of things in our region about early childhood over the last 10 years, and as we've worked over the last few with Race to the Top and as a transformation zone, and I'd like to share a few of those things with you, primarily the notion that things work differently in greater Minnesota. And I'll speak from personal experience as a father. I have 5 children. One of them is 4. Last year, he was in a program that was not parent-aware rated. And I don't say that to say anything about the program. I'm a fan of Parent Aware. I also think that scholarships have been very helpful to help us expand quality and expand access. But in our community, there was no option for me. My option was to base my decision on reputation of the provider who's lived in our community for a long time. Absent that option, my child would have not been in care. So the choice for us wasn't about a 4 versus a 3 or a 3 versus a 2 or a 2 versus a 1. It was my child is in care with someone who I know and trust, or they're not in care. And so scholarships and Parent Aware work differently in Altstate, Minnesota. And if there's one thing I hope that our message carries with today, it's that. Some other things that we've learned in our experience, that timing is very important. As a public school superintendent, I know that every spring we begin our budgeting process, and that budgeting process is based on pupil numbers. And we've had some varying experiences with our ability to predict what kind of program we're going to be able to offer in the fall based on what scholarships are going to look like. So timing is very important to us. We need to be able to make appropriate staffing and space accommodations. The second thing that we learned is that flexibility is very important. We had a situation in the first round of Pathways 2 where the biggest community in our area that had the biggest waiting list received no Pathways dollars. And so we were unable to do anything for that community with the initial Pathways round. Fortunately, in the second round, we were able to do some things differently, but we would prefer that scholarships are given to community organizations that know their communities best, that know where their needs are, and in partnership with all the players at the table can talk about where those dollars could be used the best. We also need to be able to have those discussions about facilities. Like we saw happen with All Day Everyday K, many districts responded to that wonderful funding mechanism saying, we don't know where we're going to put all these kindergartners because we're running a split schedule and we need to do something. And I think that's a realism in Altstate, Minnesota, too, and my guess is that it's no different here in the metro area. We need to be able to have space for these children that we're expanding programming for. Finally, the amount is important. In our experience, the current scholarship amount doesn't cover the cost of a slot, and so we were able to do some things programmatically to make some adjustments, and I think, again, because we come to the table as a group, we were able to make those scholarships work differently, perhaps, than in other communities, but I think that's because we were sitting at the table arm in arm with our Head Start partners and the other community partners. So To really sum it up, the recommendations I think would be that you incentivize and identify and support those communities that are willing to grab lock arm in arm and focus not on organizational boundaries but on focus on increasing quality and increasing access that I think is all of our goals that are in the room here. Second, ensure that funding is predictable, that it's dependable, that it's flexible and sufficient. And the third thing is that you'd come visit Altstate, Greater Minnesota. We're forced to work together. It's how we survive. And so I would encourage you to come and visit and see how we're working together to help little children succeed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That completes those persons that had indicated willingness to testify for now. On behalf of the committee, my colleagues here, I think I applaud each of you for your efforts in behalf of the thousands of young Minnesotans that you've provided hope and opportunity to. It's very special. That's why nearly a fourth of the legislature's here, or of the Senate's here, and you've done a great job in making progress. Our statutory goal is Ready for K. With additional funds and the effort, the numbers show we are making progress, but as you pointed out, there's increased opportunity to meet the unmet need, and that will be the challenge, how we meet that need and how do we most efficiently fund that, whether it's a permanent school trust fund initiative, which Mr. Rolnick suggested, or some other options. Those will all be before us when we meet next month. I want to also thank, before we open up to questions, Senator Scoy for being here and to get firsthand. And I know you know the high return on investment, but we appreciate your being here. And you know you're getting a great value when we send you our bill.
thank you, Mr. Chair. Do I get to make a comment right now?
Sure.
I find this very interesting. I think the return is very good. As I read my notes here, understanding about reaching all the children, universal access, a holistic approach, and then I listen to him talking about the waiting lists and all the needs, and I think that you ought to make four-year-old a grade and let these folks emphasize their program on 0 to 3-year-olds and have the state take four-year-olds as a grade.
Was that Senate File 1 or?
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, I have already been in contact with the Senate's education staff, and we yes. have started drafting. And we could follow the model of Oklahoma, and I think they're the only state in the nation that does this. But the demonstrated return on their investment from having a four-year-old be a grade is pretty tremendous. And it would do away with waiting lists, and it would do away with all the differing programs that are not all the time working together. And I think it's something that this committee should explore.
Well, as we say, it's in the mix. So thank you. And Representative Mullery, we want to welcome you. Thank you
thank
for
you
joining
for
us and for your efforts as chair of the House
the table.
Committee.
Thank
so,
you.
Thank you. And now, members, we'd like to open it up for questions, comments. For any of the testifiers, and yes, Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have just three different testifiers. Can I just call them up to the table?
Yes.
That I want to ask questions to briefly.
Will that take us past four?
No way.
Okay.
I promise.
Okay.
No.
If we try to do that within about 3 to 4 minutes.
No, it'll be very quickly.
Okay.
The folks I'd like to get some more information from would be Erica Moss with Parent Aware. And Superintendent Gross from, I think, is the Wilmore Public Schools.
Deer River.
And the Reading Corps, Mr. Hernandez or Ms. Markovitz. Those are kind of the three areas that I just had some questions on.
Hey, Ms. Moss is there.
Yep, thank you so much. Well, I know everyone in this room realizes how important it is that our kids are prepared and ready to learn when they get to kindergarten. And we know that that will go a long ways to closing our achievement gap, something we're not proud of in Minnesota, that we have the largest achievement gap. So the question is, you know, what's the best way to get there? And I think that's what today's hearing was about. And as a senator who represents rural Minnesota, and I'd like to have Ms. Moss kind of talk a little bit about this idea of rural Minnesota, outstate Minnesota, and how many of our are we finding providers that are trained in the four stars, and where are we with that? Because we're a little further now than we were when we last met, because I think the rollout has happened. So can you speak specifically to rural Minnesota and the preparation of child care providers?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, thanks for your question. A quick reminder that my organization, we're an independent nonprofit supporting the expansion of the rating. The rating system and program is run through the Minnesota Department of Human Services, which is part of the Office of Early Learning. So I can address your question generally, but if you want more specifics, I think there are some colleagues here from the Department of Human Services. What we're seeing when we started the statewide expansion in 2012, Where we saw numbers lagging after a period of time on the ground was in the metro area. We were doing better with relationship to the targets that were set in greater Minnesota. And that trend has continued. We've actually caught up now in the metro area and are doing well in the metro area too. But what I'll say about greater Minnesota, and there are others here at the table who can speak, it's been about 15 years since I've lived in greater Minnesota, so there are others who can speak from their experiences there today. But what we're finding is that that getting local and building local relationships is not surprisingly really, really important. And what Parent Aware in and of itself isn't really an intervention. It's a framework for organizing things. It organizes investments in supporting providers. It organizes giving information to parents. So what we're finding is that the availability of this broadly available statewide framework is that we've been able to attract local organizations, local community partners who've attracted private funding that they've invested in, in further reducing the rates of the training that's available, or in bringing partners to the table, or having difficult conversations with child care providers about what the rating system is, and helping them to come into the rating system. So there are some greater Minnesota communities that are actually, more than half a dozen, I think, great examples of ways that this is going really, really well through this voluntary kind of rewards-based system. So nobody's mandated to do it. We're counting on people to raise their hands, and through these local partnerships, we're increasingly seeing providers raise their hands and volunteer to participate in the system.
Thank you. Just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Wouldn't follow up, but then we're going to ask other members
that have questions. Okay. Well, at another hearing, hopefully we'll delve into the pathway too. There's some discussion about that, and whether the scholarships go to the student and the parents, empowering parents and families and students, or if they go to institutions. And so I think I'm hopeful, Mr. Chair, that we'll have a further chance for that. So for today, then I'd like Mr. Hernandez to speak just a bit about the reading core results and just why we think it's replicable. I know it is. The results are stellar, and full disclosure, I'm on the board for Serve Minnesota. So, but I would like you for the committee to explain about why the results are replicable and why we have seen such great results from this evidence-based results reading initiative, pre-reading, pre-literacy, and
Mr.
just
Hernandez.
Kind of explain that, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson. So you started to answer my question for me. So evidence-based interventions and best practices. I mean, what the Reading Corps does. So as part of our process assessment, that was one of the main goals, was to look at why are we finding the effects that we're finding objectively through the quantitative analysis. And what we found was the training that the Reading Corps provides to its members and, importantly, to the staff at the school. I think something that I'd like to emphasize a little more strongly than we did in the presentation was that the Reading Corps model is a model that's intended to impact the entire classroom environment, and there is emphasis on improving the entire school environment at the pre-K level. So the training that the Reading Corps provides is provided not only to the members that serve in the classrooms, but also to the staff at the school. And then there's ongoing coaching that's there to help make sure that the members are implementing and the staff are implementing the interventions and the practices that are provided in the training with fidelity. And that training is provided through on-site coaching, through a literacy, the person who's usually in charge of literacy and language development in the school, as well as master coaches that are provided by Serve Minnesota, the Minnesota Reading Corps, that come in from the outside. So I think it's the combination of the training, specifically the Seeds of Emergent Literacy professional development curriculum, as well as the coaching, and the fact that it is curriculum neutral. So, and it's agnostic about what type of program that it's in. So it can be in a Head Start center, it can be in a community-based program, it can be in a public school, and it can operate equally effectively with any type of curriculum.
Excuse me, Mr. Hernandez. Senator Hoffman had a question on the study, so maybe we'll, while you're on that.
Thank you. Thank you for the clarification. Mr. Hernandez, NORC, I sat here for 5 minutes and had to think the National Opinion Research Center. Is that correct?
It used to be.
Thank you. That brings back some sociological discussions in my old world life. But one of the things, in understanding the methodology, I'd sure like to go a little deeper into what your results have, because you just touched the surface. But, you know, when you talk about all students benefiting from these programs, you know, there's one-third of the students out there have a special health care need, and we address that as a right, you know, under 504, Section 504 of the Rehab Act, and of course, under IEPs and IFSPs. But my question to you is, what kind of results did you find studying, you know, the one-third of the population that has a special health care need or even a developmental disability that might perhaps be in there? And if not, why not? And if you did, maybe you can just share a link with me, and I won't take up any time from this committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator. So the study that we conducted was not designed to look specifically at special subpopulations. It was to look at the impact of the program on the whole class. So when I presented the results that we presented to you are results, average results across all students in the classroom. Now, we did do some subgroup analysis, and we mentioned that the dual language learners, students who are free and reduced price lunch eligible at public schools, et cetera, that we found that there was no differential impact of the program for the most part, but where they were, that it benefited those students who were dual language learners, for example, or of color. We did not look at students who had developmental disabilities, though they were included in the larger sample. We did not exclude anyone from the analysis. Generally, the sample sizes, to answer very specifically, the sample size would not be sufficient to do that.
Brief follow-up, and then we'll go to the superintendent.
Correct. I just wanted to make a comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you for letting me expand on this. That's the highest rate of people that are without employment in the state of Minnesota, the highest rate of people that don't graduate, the highest amount of grade of people that are into poverty. And we talk about closing achievement gaps. Uh-huh. You know, I would like us to start seeing more and more analysis done on that special population, because the end result is it's costing a lot of money to do it. So right. I'm sad that you broke out some subcategorical places, but you didn't do it there. And I just want to make one more comment. Matt and Ms. Wambanek, thank you for reminding us about flexibility. We have to remember that each local school district has to have the flexibility to make their money the way they do it and to pay it. So thank you, Mr. Hernandez. I have no more questions.
Thanks. And we have the contact info for follow-up, which there will be. And
yes, thank you.
Thank you for visiting. Sarah Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be very brief, because I think there's a lot of questions here at the table. So, Superintendent Gross, I was just curious briefly about your comment that I think you were speaking for the Rural Education Association, perhaps, that you would prefer scholarships actually go to a particular place as opposed to parents. I just wanted you to kind of elaborate on that a little bit. Is it because you don't know, because there's not enough of the rated sites in rural Minnesota? Or what, if you could just briefly kind of elaborate on that comment a little bit.
Sure. My opinion, and I'm not an economist, first of all, is that the scholarship model works really great when there is, when supply and demand are in some form of equality, that there are as many parents asking for places for their children as there are places for their children to go, because then the places for the children to go realize that there's some significant incentive to become that four-star rated program. So in rural Minnesota, we're our experience, and again, I'm speaking for Deer River, poor community in northern Minnesota, but my experience in up and around that area speaks to the idea that the demand for care exceeds the supply. So there are more parents wanting places for their children to go than there are places for them to go. And so that scholarship doesn't really get them anything if there's no place for them to cash it in. So when we had Pathways 2 scholarships that came to our community, that we were able as a group to make a plan for, we were able to distribute those dollars in ways that could benefit our entire region. And part of the benefit of what we have is the ability to lock arms with Center-Based and Head Starts and our Invest Early program and do that together. But that's, I guess that's my direct answer to your question.
Thank you. We'll follow up later because I know there's a lot of questions here at the table. So thank you very much.
Important questions. All. Thank you. Senator Kent, followed by Senator Hall and others. Let me know.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief comment. I'm also on the board of Serve Minnesota with Senator Nelson and Representative Mulley, and just wanted to bring up something that I will share via email with the committee after the fact. I know time is short here, but there's a video that's been done in conjunction with this research that I think does a really great job of illustrating how the program works and why the whole site-based approach is important, and that's a big part of the methodology as well. But I will send that out so that people can – it's a short video, very user-friendly. Hopefully webmail will be – or the new email will be working and work for us well.
Thank you to all the legislators serving on that group. We'll look forward to that. And Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if Ms. Yost is still here. I could ask her a question.
Yes, she's right behind you, in fact.
My neck got your back far.
Ms. Yost.
Hi, Ms. Yost. You had just briefly said something about concern of Pathway 1 and 2. Could you elaborate a little bit more on that?
A little bit, because it was something that someone told me. A few of the superintendents in rural Minnesota that I talked to had concerns about Pathway 1 and Pathway 2, and I don't really know exactly what those concerns were, but there was confusion about it.
Okay.
And I think part of the confusion is, I think it's Pathway 1, if I'm correct, goes to the family, and Pathway 2 goes to the center or to the school. Mm-hmm. And so there was confusion about how could they access both if they were able to, and they also had a question of could they access both.
Okay, thank you, Ms.
Sorry, I don't know more than that about it.
That's okay. And
Senator Hall.
Oh, did you want to say more about that?
If you want me to elaborate on
Pathway
1.
Sure. Ms. Hilden. Yes, that's okay. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, Nancy Hilden, and on behalf of Many Minds. So the Pathway 1, just to give you a little quick background, Pathway 1s go directly to a family on a waiting list somewhere, and they take that and can go to school readiness. They can use it in Head Start. They can use it wherever they choose. Pathway 2 was specifically designed so that when you had a provider, whether it was a school or a Head Start or a private provider that was quality, but in order to expand to have another classroom, for example, of preschool, they need to have a quantity, because you're not going to hire another teacher for preschool if you only get one scholarship. And so the intent behind Pathway 2 was to assure a quantity of scholarships in one setting, and then let the families choose to go there. So that has not always worked out. There is a bit of a portability question that is coming up now in certain areas where a provider, even though the statute says that once you're a kid in a scholarship, you get that till you're in kindergarten, there have been some instances where a kid leaves a Pathway 2 type scholarship, and then they leave the program. So, and they don't get, their scholarship isn't going. What it requires is some reserves, because there is high mobility in poor families. And so what you need to do is hold some in reserve so that when that family does move, that child retains a scholarship, but that you get to backfill with another child who wants to be in that Pathway 2 program. So I'm sorry to take much time, but I wanted to clarify. That's what some of the confusion has been.
Good. Thank you. This is Nancy Jost. I do remember a comment that one of the superintendents made about Pathways was that they couldn't figure out the formula for why some schools were eligible and some weren't. And they thought that, you know, they were a school that had more poverty than another school, and yet they weren't eligible. And I think it comes down to the bottom, you know, bottom line is that there just aren't enough scholarships available across the state.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, if I may?
Yes, Senator Hall.
I think that's something we could look at and try to clarify if need be this year. The other comment that I heard, and I don't know all of education, but I hear a lot of people talk about high-quality education for vulnerable kids. And I think we ought to talk about the highest quality of education for vulnerable kids, that the best teachers are there for the vulnerable kids, because I think they may need it. So I don't know. That's just kind of my theme this year, and I'd like to talk more about it as we go on.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hall. Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to underscore a couple of things. One, building off what Senator Skoy said about perhaps if we can address the universal four-year-old need, we could then use our targeted dollars for 0 to 3. And just a comment on the 0 to 3 group, I know Art Rolnick has moved from talking about scholarships, which, because I think there's been then an understanding that that is important, to talking about starting at prenatal, and he talks about home visiting. The home visiting that happens then is the health-based home visiting, which I just, you know, I know Judy Helper thanked me. It's because I'm this huge champion of the literacy-based home visiting, because that's just the perfect streamline. You move from the health-based to the literacy-based, and then you move them into a high-quality pre-K environment, and then you do, when they get in school, you do the, you know, pre-K to grade 3 and the Serve Minnesota, and it all really is a streamlined approach to making sure with velocity we attack these disparities. And so I'm just proud of our community and what people are bringing forward. And I want to thank Senator Saxhog for your community being that pilot site for the literacy base. And as Judy said, it's going really well. So thank you.
Excellent. Any further questions or comments by members? If not, thank you very much for your excellent attention. Again, to all the testifiers, for a job well done. We will be revisiting this very soon. Members, we're adjourned.